Good evening, everyone. This is Lou speaking, and this is Spotlight, the interview show which occurs every other week, hopefully, if we have a good guest, and we always have good guests, we think. Tonight, we're going to be talking to someone that you're very familiar with on the site. His name is Parker Waddington, and you know that he's offered courses on various aspects of Windows, but we're not going to be talking about his teaching tonight, except indirectly. And I wanted to say that sometimes you meet a person or you hear them in person, and the warmth and charm of their personality comes through in their voice. And I think Parker is one of those individuals. You can tell he's a true son of the Midwest, a man who has confidence in himself and what he's doing, and I think that'll come through as this interview progresses. Are you there, Parker?
Yes, I am, Lou. Anything I say after that introduction is probably going to destroy my image.
Well, in 50 minutes or so, we're going to build that up, believe me. Parker, I said I introduced you as a true son of the Midwest. What does that mean? Does that mean you were born and raised in Iowa?
Yes, I was, Lou. I was born and raised in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Not too many years ago, I think. Maybe in those depression-racked 30s, but we won't get into the exact year. Now, when you were going to school in public schools, of course, you didn't detect any problem you had with your vision at that time, did you? That came a little later?
No, I really didn't. The only thing that I was aware of at all was that I didn't have much night vision, but you know, I didn't think anything about it. In fact, I just thought that was the way it was.
But when you were around 16, you realized something more was going on, didn't you? What was it?
Well, when I was about 16, I started having some vision difficulties, and I went to an ophthalmologist, and he informed me that I had a retinal condition, and this particular doctor, at that age, didn't put a name with it. But he told me that it was probably going to cause some problems down the road.
And that's about all he said. He didn't say that this thing could lead to total blindness, did he?
No, he did. He actually didn't. In fact, he was the first doctor I saw. And then a few years later, oh, probably at that time it was 18, 19, or 20, there was a new ophthalmologist came into town who was had an excellent reputation. I went to him, and he did diagnose it as retinitis pigmentosa, but he didn't really tell me that, you know, that I could end up being blind either.
So, as a young man, you just blithely went on, applied to your local college there, got accepted, and you began majoring in something. What was that, Parker?
I started out majoring in journalism because I was a photography nut. I loved photography, so I wanted to follow in that. And I started out majoring in journalism and majored in it for 2 years, at which time the college politely invited me in and informed me that they were no longer going to have journalism. And if I wanted to continue in journalism, I had to transfer, by which I would lose quite a few credits. And our family financial situation wasn't that great. I couldn't afford to lose too many credits. So we looked at options, and the next number of courses I had most was history, which I love and always have. And so I ended up being a history major with an English minor, thanks to all the journalism courses.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear I'm in good company. Of course, you know I was a history major, but not an English minor. My mine was history, government, economics. Those gloomy, dismal courses, of course. Well, Parker, so you switched over to history, Did you have any intent with doing anything with history, or was it just something you loved and you just wanted to major in it?
No, I really didn't, Lou. I was kind of floundering around in my early years. I didn't really intend to do anything with history. I had gotten a job at a camera shop during the time I was teaching or going to college, and when I came out of college, I was hired full time as an employee there. And within a very short time after I started working there, one of the owners of the shop had a aorta rupture and died quite suddenly. Just a year or so of the time I graduated college, I ended up being the manager of that camera shop.
Why don't you tell us what you did after the camera shop up to the point when you realized that RP was no joke and you had it and it was destroying your vision in a unfortunate manner?
Okay. I managed the camera shop for several years. That was during the time in the late 50s when all of the discount stores were coming in, and the prices that these people could sell those cameras and things for was just more than what that store could deal with, and it finally just folded up. Then I went on and I had a varied career. I sold water softeners for a while. I sold insurance for a year. I worked in a car dealership as a service advisor for quite a few years. And then I was hired by the Cedar Rapids Community School District, actually as the Assistant Director of Transportation, working with school buses and what have you. And during the time that I was doing that, I had a few, my eye doctor had told me that I was developing cataracts, but that they could be removed when they got bad enough. And that would probably be a big help. So I went into the eye doctor and said, okay, I'm having problems. It's time to take the cataracts off. So he did a thorough examination. I was at that probably, he did a very thorough examination, and he came over, and he really was a nice guy. And in fact, I think that was part of the reason he hadn't told me the whole story earlier. He just kind of sat down and put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, there's not much point in taking the cataracts off because there's nothing under there. You've got what's called retinitis pigmentosa, and he said eventually you will probably lose your eyesight, but he said there's no way to tell you how fast it'll happen because it's so individualistic.
So at about the age of 30, you finally got the bad word. Now, what I want to deal with next is, how did you cope with this? You seem to have an optimistic outlook. I know you have a strong faith. Did these things work for you, or was there something else in the mix that helped you cope with this onset of blindness?
Well, Lou, you know, it's kind of hard for me to tell you. I think it all kind of combined. This happened on a Friday, fortunately, and I went home and walked into the house and told my wife what he'd said. And basically, I sat down in the rocking chair, and I don't remember having moved a whole lot that entire weekend. I just simply sat there and kind of, you know, thought through. I didn't know what to do. This had never been in my plans because my mother had never told me. I found out later that she had known that there could be eye problems, but she'd never told me for whatever reason. I don't really know why she didn't, because we had a very good relationship. But at the end, you know, by the time the first of the week came, I made up my mind. I had a wife, I had a house, I had three little girls, and I said, basically said, well, if you sit here in the rocking chair, that's not gonna bring any bread home to the table. So I made up my mind it was time to get up and get moving, and I started making inquiries. Looked up the number for the Iowa Commission for the Blind, called down there, and said, okay, this is the situation. What do I do? And they said, first thing you do is come on down and when we'll talk. And that's what I did.
I think you said when I spoke to you earlier that you got married in 1958. How supportive was your wife, Jane, in this crisis?
That was a struggle. In some ways, she was very, very supportive. And what I did was I went back to school. I had my BA, and I went back to school under the auspices of the Iowa Commission for the Blind and got a teaching certificate, and Jane was wonderful. And she helped me read and supported me in a lot of ways. But she was really struggling with the fact that the girls might possibly be carriers or might end up with it. And for her, that was a real battle, and it was, you know, it was a battle for her too, because she didn't realize that I, you know, might end up being blind. But it took a while, but we worked through it, and she was a very wonderful, very supportive wife.
And she was something else also. She was a teacher, and in many ways she sort of guided you and helped you overcome maybe any fears you had in getting into the teaching field, which would have meant teaching normally sighted people. So here you are, Parker, at about 30. You had been driving a car, doing everything normally, and this calamity, if I may call it that, descended on you. You took a weekend, you reviewed your options, and you moved forward with the help of your family and your wife. And how did you get into the teaching field? Was that difficult at that time?
No. I think the good Lord was looking out for me. At that particular time, they were desperate for teachers. And Jane had always been my kind of shining example. I saw how much she loved teaching. And I actually had gone to school with her and visited on a number of occasions. And I thought, I wish I had done that when I was in college. And so when the Iowa Commission for the Blind said to me, they said, you know, we will provide money for retraining. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I really think I want to be a teacher. And they said, wait a minute. That would mean in order for you to be a teacher, you're going to have to take about $1,000 a year pay cut, and we don't want you to do that. So we had a little discussion, and I informed them, I want to be a teacher. I don't care if I have to take $1,000 a year pay cut. That's what I want to do. So they sent me back to school to become a teacher.
So, the Iowa Commission at that time was, of course, the sterling example of what a state commission for the blind should be and how it should operate. And of course, they had a magnificent leader at that time, who we'll get into in a moment. They actually were discouraging you, and that was one of the sterling state agencies. But you just sort of ignored that, went in. And what was the worst week of teaching for you, Parker Hill, outside of scared?
I'm sorry, I didn't know, like, what was my first week of teaching like?
Yes, that's right. Tell us about that.
Well, my first week of teaching was a revelation. And getting a very funny experience happened. The very first day I student taught, and any teacher will tell you that when you teach a group of young 25 or 30 young kids, it's a mental challenge to stay ahead all the time and keep up, and it's exhausting. And for years, when I've been doing these other jobs, I would come home and I'd say to my wife, let's go to the movie, let's do this, let's do that. She said, I'm too tired and I've got homework, I just did schoolwork, I just don't have enough energy to do it. The first night that I came home from my student teaching, we lived in a split foyer. I walked up the flight of stairs to the living room and I sat down in the closest chair, and I kind of threw my head back on the chair and hung my arms over the side. About 10 minutes later, my wife walked in the door. She took one look, and she collapsed on the stairs in hysterical laughter, couldn't hardly get up. She says, I've been telling you that for 10 years, and he said you wouldn't believe me. But no, I found out that I kind of had a natural aptitude for teaching, that I loved it. I got on well with the other teachers, and I got on well with the kids.
Yes, that certainly comes through in the courses you offer on For the People. You do have a gift for it, and you do get along easily with people. You like people, and I think they like you in return. No, teaching is exhausting, and of course you got stronger and stronger, and you number of elementary grades, I think you said third and sixth and even eighth grade. So you had a variety of age groups. Now, in addition to your teaching, You got involved in the consumer movement in Iowa, National Federation for the Blind. How did that start, and what role did you play in the Iowa NFB?
Well, I'm going to level with you. It started because at that time in the state of Iowa, although it was not legal for them to say so, Ken Jernigan was the commissioner for the blind of the state of Iowa. He was also president of the NFB, and the two organizations were basically run out of his. And very quietly, very subtly, it was suggested, never outright, or you were receiving benefits from the state of Iowa, you really ought to belong to the NFB and support the blind movement. So I just thought, well, okay. So I started going. And over the years, I became the president of the local chapter in Cedar Rapids, and was for 3 or 4 years. And you know, was quite active in doing things with the blind and for the blind there.
So what began as pressure on you to join developed into a leadership role for you, and you came in contact with Kenneth Jernigan and some other memorable figures in the consumer organization movement. And what was Kenneth Jernigan like? You met him many times, you spoke with him many times. What was your impression of him?
Well, Ken Jernigan was a remarkable man. He was actually, in my opinion, brilliant. He was a very, very powerful personality. I mean, you literally knew when he walked in the room, you just sort of sensed it. He, very honestly, also had a pretty good ego. And I sat in on a number of discussions and various events with him. And in one case, I made a statement on a television show that he didn't quite agree with. And he corrected me, saying, that's not what Mr. Waddington quite meant. And he redid my words right on the spot. And he was that type of personality, but I have a lot of respect for him because he did a tremendous amount for the blind, but unfortunately also in the process did quite a bit to the blind too.
I think you told me of an incident when you made a statement, not in front of him, but they presented you with a written statement on some matter, and they wanted you to sign off on it, and you refused to do it. Was that the beginning of your disillusionment with the NFB?
Yeah, pretty much it was, Lou. I'll tell you the whole story. It's an interesting story. Ken Jernigan, as I said, was a very, very powerful personality. And as far as he was concerned, there were two sides to any question, his and the opposition's. And there was no middle ground. You were either with him or you were against him. And, you know, people like that make a lot of enemies. And he did. He made a lot of enemies in the state of Iowa. And actually, it ended up taking Iowa. Actually, they stepped after Ken Jernigan left. They actually went backwards quite a while because of what he'd done. But anyway, what actually happened was these opponents accused him of fortifying the Iowa Commission for the Blind building and installing bulletproof glass in the front doors. They were making this a fortress, and they were bringing in weapons. Well, it was ridiculous. I mean, there were definitely no weapons. There was definitely no bulletproof glass or anything like that. And they came from Des Moines. The local TV station in Cedar Rapids had given an editorial very much opposed to Ken Jernigan. And they came from Des Moines to see me, and they walked in. It was the president of the Iowa chapter at the time, and I can't remember who the other person was. There was two of them. And they said, we brought this statement that we want you to present on the local TV station, and we want you to sign off on it. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, I don't sign off on anything that I haven't read. And so I had my wife read it to me. And I said to them, okay, guys, I agree with some of what you're saying, but I said, I don't agree with all of it. And I said, what I will do is take what part I agree with, I'll use that, and I'll rewrite the rest in my own words in saying what I believe. And, oh, they were not happy. And I said, that's it. I said, if you want me to do this, that's the way it's going to be, or I don't do it. And I did do it my way. And from then on, I was sort of persona non grata as far as they were concerned. And I really began, that was the beginning of my disillusionment with the movement.
Yeah, that was an unfortunate approach they made to you. Thinking back over those years with the NFB and working with Ken Jernigan, what do you think were the most interesting areas of progress that you were involved in? I don't mean the whole list, but some of the highlights.
The main thing that I attempted to do as the president of the local Cedar Rapids chapter was we tried to bring the blind movement out into the public eye. We created a lot of public service announcements. We did a lot of appearances on local television and radio talk shows. In the process of all this, in between the NFB and my teaching, I got involved with the American Red Cross, the cardiopulmonary, the CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation movement was just getting going at that time. I ended up being an instructor for the Red Cross, and I thought this would be a great thing for the blind because it's a touch-feel thing, and there's very little vision needed. So I taught the local chapter how to do CPR, and they did great. I mean, the fact that they were used to doing things by feel, they were just really good at it. And the local TV station even came out and covered that event and took pictures showing us doing it. And they interviewed us and we talked about it. But that was basically the highlight. We tried very hard to get the movement out into the open to make the people aware of it. We made appearances around and talked, did everything we could to put the blind in a good light.
Well, thank you for telling us that. I can see that you did achieve something there in public awareness. Now, in addition to teaching and your extracurricular activities with the NF, I know you've been in your church and probably even in Sunday school, but what about on leisure time? Could you tell us something about that?
Well, we were you know, very much involved in our family activities. A lot of my leisure time was actually taken up with the three girls. They were going through high school at that time and were cheerleaders and what have you. And Jean and I made a point of going to their games, and we just dearly loved. We followed the teams on the road, and we loved basketball and loved football, and you know, enjoyed going to the cheerleading. I actually enjoyed part of my leisure time was I became actually a CPR instructor trainer for the Red Cross, and to me that was leisure time. I enjoyed training new instructors to teach that. That was kind of how I went out and relaxed. I just thought that was fun, and I liked to do it.
So you were teaching instructors in what, first aid?
Actually, I became what's called an CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation instructor trainer. I was training new instructors for them to go out and teach the public. Probably over a 12-year period, trained probably between 100 and 200 of them.
100 or 200 students, did you say, Parker? I kind of went blank here for a minute.
Between 100 and 200 new instructors. I did more training of instructors than I did actually students.
I see. Well, you're sort of teaching on the graduate level, I guess, for the Red Cross. I guess you might call it that. Well, I think you told me that you put in 20 years of teaching, and around 1989, you made a decision to quit. What prompted that decision, outside of the 20 years? All that, there was something else, wasn't there?
Yeah, I decided in 1989, the retinitis was going into, during the years that I taught, I had a tiny central core of vision. And the retinitis started going into that area, and I became concerned about my ability to provide for the safety of the kids. That was my primary reason for retiring. And that particular time, there were a lot of battles over custody going on, and there were a number of cases in Iowa nationwide of parents coming to playgrounds and taking their kids off the playground and actually illegally snatching them from the other parent. And I simply was not able any longer to see far enough to see the edge of the playground to really tell what was happening. So I was very concerned that I might be unable to provide for the safety of the kids, and decided at that time that it was time for me to retire, and I had in enough time teaching that I could take a normal retirement at 20 years and go on disability from Social Security. So that's exactly what I did do after I talked it over with my wife.
Yes, and after you talked it over with your wife, you look forward to a good retirement. And as so often happens in life, the unexpected happens. And in 1994, something happened to Jane, didn't it?
Yeah, 1994 was the year I just as soon forget. Jane had a hysterectomy early in the year, about March, and went through that great, just absolutely fine. And about along June, maybe May, June, along in there, noticed some twinges in her abdomen when she would lean up against something, and really thought that it was probably, healing going on from the hysterectomy, so didn't really pursue it. About into July, she started getting flu symptoms, at least what she thought were flu symptoms, and was having some problems, and we kept saying, go to the doctor. Jane was not one to go to the doctor. Frankly, I'm not either. But she didn't like to go to the doctors, and we kept trying to get her to go to the doctor. Well, her abdomen started to distend, and at that point we said, that's it, you're going to the doctor. So we took her to the hospital one night, and she had they had to put in a nasal gastric tube to get the fluids out of her stomach. And the local hospital was kind of didn't quite know exactly what to do. They did some tests and didn't really come up with an answer, and they wanted to do exploratory surgery. And I wasn't comfortable with that, and neither was she. And so we took her to the Mayo Clinic, and they diagnosed her with gastrointestinal cancer, or actually gastric cancer, stomach cancer. And they honest and truly thought they were going to be able to get it. And they went in and came back to the room after the surgery and just literally, I mean, you normally don't see doctors break down in tears, but they did. And they told us that, there's no way. It's just all through her stomach. And they cried with us. And that was like about the 17th of August. She died the 2nd of November.
And a couple of months later, she was gone. And that was probably the second greatest loss in your life, next to your loss of vision. How did you... I know you're a coping kind of individual, Parker. You show all the signs of that. Your voice, your personality. How did you cope with that tragic loss?
Well, actually, Lou, I'm going to correct your statement on that. That was by far the greatest loss of my life. My eyes, I would put my eyes as second. Once Jane coped with the loss of my sight, she became my eyes. I mean, we'd drive places and she'd describe scenery and she'd tell me things, and if I needed something read, she'd read it, and just, really did anything I'd ask her to do, and it was just a wonderful person. I really struggled with it, believe me. I'm blessed. The Lord has been very good to me. He gave me a wonderful wife. He's given me three wonderful daughters. And the girls and Jane and I at Rochester talked things over. And it was a family decision that they all wanted me to. And my oldest daughter is, not in physical appearance, but she's in personality and in manners, the mirror image of my wife. And that's what I did. And I struggled. I mean, I did a lot of reading and a lot of talking with my minister and a lot of talking with God and everybody else. And gradually, I mean, it took me a couple of years, probably, but I gradually worked my way through it. And I knew, I had no choice but to go on, because there was a reason I'm still here. And to be very honest, I kind of wonder if it wasn't maybe for the people. I don't know. Might be.
Well, one thing you did, and is very instructive, is you changed your environment. You sold your house in Sioux City, Iowa, and you moved down with your daughter in Missouri. You entered a whole new family and contributed there. And then, how did you discover For the People?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story in itself. I use Window Eyes. When I moved here to Springfield, I met a blind computer programmer here, and he set me up with Window Eyes. And I thought, well, if I'm using Window Eyes, it might be a good idea to be on the GW Micro list. And one day I was reading the GW info list, and there was a request from a guy who was looking for a virus program to use. And he wanted to know what everybody was suggesting. His name happened to be Alex Ray. And so I wrote Alex a letter and said, hey, I'm using Norton 2 at that time, probably 2000, and it works great. And he wrote back, and we got acquainted, and we still called each other on the phone a few times and talked. And finally, Alex said, hey, do you know about Four of the People? And I said, no, I don't. But, and I had seen, I think Jennifer put something on the GW Info list one time, because I remember seeing something about it in the name Jennifer Burton. And Alex said, well, you got to try this out. So I did.
And it was a lucky chance, wasn't it? Because you found so many good friends and so many friends found you. And not only did you talk and chat, but you've now begun a whole series of courses and instructing people. How did that come about? Is that that innate desire to teach that you've had all your life?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I spoke those famous words to Jennifer, what can I do to help? And one thing kind of led to another, and here we go.
Yes, you've made a contribution, and you continue to make a contribution every day that you're on here. And I, for one, want to thank you, and I'm sure I'm speaking for all the other people who have had the opportunity to learn from you and sit in on your classes. I just want to mention, Parker, before I let you go, that Parker tonight, despite thank you very much for giving this time and giving my listeners time, and this insight into your life and how you had coped unfortunate things that came along. Of course, we all, maybe you've had coping situations, but still keep your good and your good humor. And I want you again for coming on.
My shining example of how of my humor is my mother. Was my mother. She could laugh in the midst of disaster. And my grandfather always told the story about hearing the crash one day when he was sitting on the front porch, went out and found that somehow she'd missed the side of the door of the garage and hit the side dead center, knocked the garage off its foundation, and was sitting there laughing, red-faced with laughter. And so I learned from her that how you treat people, they tend to treat you the same way back. So I tend to treat people with good humor and dignity, and I just generally find they respond pretty much the same way. So I use my mother as my example of that.
Well, I think that's a splendid example, and I think I would have laughed too. I think I've driven a car into the back of a garage once. I didn't knock it off its foundation, but I certainly did some damage to those 2x4s. But that's another story. Parker, thank you again for coming on and putting up with the internet goblins and trolls. And I could call them something else, but I won't. This is a family site. And I want to say that in 2 weeks, we'll have another guest, and hopefully the internet will be heard, and my guest will be heard, and we'll have another, hopefully, illuminating interview. Thank you very much, everyone. Good night.
Thank you, Lou. You do a great job.
You're a great guest, Parker. And I wish you lived closer. I'd be drinking coffee with you every night.
I'd love it.
Thank you, Lou, and thank you, Parker. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to ask Parker?
I have one for you, Mrs. Producer. Will you email me your next time's guest?
It's going to be Mr. Straight Shooter. Well, I wish I had you around to teach CPR. I'd love to learn that technique. I think we all should know it.
You know, actually, now I wouldn't be able to teach it. They have changed that so much since the time that I taught it that I actually wouldn't be able to teach it now. I could show you the old method, which is fairly simple, but I wouldn't actually be certified to do it anymore.
Good evening, folks. Parker, I do have a question for you. I live in Colorado, and I have tried for several things to be an instructor through the Red Cross for water safety and teaching young adults, children, basically, to be babysitters. And in both cases, because of my disability, they said they could not give me my certificate. How did you manage to get yours?
I have a feeling, and this is only my own personal opinion, that it is probably the individual people that you're dealing with and not the Red Cross itself. The people that I had happened to come in contact with in Cedar Rapids were very open-minded. As long as I could pass the test, they would certify me. There was no problem. I don't know that there's any problem as far as the national is concerned. I don't think there could be. I think you're running into a couple of individuals there. I was fortunate. I received great support. In fact, they actually nominated me for the Iowa Red Cross Man of the Year one year. Didn't happen to get it, but they nominated me for it anyway.
Thank you for answering the question. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. I wish you good luck. I hope they will accept you because you'd be a good addition to them. There's no reason why you can't do a lot of that.
Do you think if I went over the state's Red Cross to the national, anything would change?
It's possible. That's hard to say. Unfortunately, as you well know, with being blind, it has a lot to do with who you run into. And as many, many times, it's actually not the organization, but it's the person that you're dealing with. It would be certainly worth a try. You can't lose anything.
That is called prejudice.
You got that right. That's exactly what it is. And it's what we face, you know, pretty much every day in one form or another.
And it's very difficult to get past, especially with people in today's society.
Yeah, unfortunately it is, because it's usually pretty subtle. They're never blatant and come right out and say it. It's always kind of very subtle these little reasons that they give you that really aren't the honest to goodness reason. Well, see, when the water safety, I can't speak to that because with the CPR, I passed with flying colors all of the qualifications. And they, you ask if it might make a difference. It might, because the Red Cross there actually promoted me as a blind CPR instructor. There was no attempt on their part to keep the fact that I was blind a secret. In fact, I was interviewed. They set up an interview with some Chicago radio station over the telephone. So they got information out that far from Cedar Rapids that I was blind and was teaching CPR. So I'm sure that the national must have known about it.